I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump used the word carnage to describe the state of the country at his inauguration last year. Last night, at his first State of the Union address, he talked about common ground, one American family, a new American moment, and that there's never been a better time to start living the American dream. While the economy continues to improve, which normally results in popularity for a president, Trump's approval rating is at 37%, according to the Pew Research Center. Democrats countered with five responses. You heard that right, to Trump's speech. We asked Philip Bump to join us. He's national correspondent for the Washington Post covering politics. And Philip Bump, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Was the president the right messenger to deliver this message, not entirely of cooperation and compromise, but was he the right speaker?
Well, I mean, he was unavoidably the speaker, right? I mean, it's certainly, if there were a Republican president who made the case that Donald Trump made last night in broad strokes, it's possible that the reception could have been different because that Republican president may not have had 1 year as president and 1 year as president and candidate combined, who had said a lot of very divisive things, advocated a lot of very divisive policy positions. And I think that part of the challenge that Trump faces is that we have seen repeatedly that he is able to give speeches that include rhetoric, which in another context might be appealing, that's then quickly undercut on Twitter or in interviews by what most people assume is his real feeling about working with the opposition.
In fact, I've seen more and more there's teleprompter Trump and then there's Twitter Trump. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, that is absolutely true. I mean, it is both a clever way of looking at it and an accurate reflection of the two sides of the president.
Any tweets this morning so far?
So far, no. So we'll see. I mean, one of the things that we saw last year after he gave his joint address to Congress, which got generally positive reviews, is that he seemed pretty content with that, and he seemed pretty happy. And then that all fell apart after questions were raised about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' meetings with Russians. And then by the weekend, Donald Trump was accusing President Obama of having wiretapped Trump Tower. So we'll see. So far, you know, it's been, 12 hours? So far, so good.
Well, and there's a lot going on behind the scenes, which I do want to talk to you about. Obviously, immigration is an important issue in Washington, D.C. It's something that he raised last night. But he framed it in many ways by that just tragic story of the parents who lost two daughters to this horrifying gang called MS-13. But he seemed to paint immigrants with that brush.
That's exactly right. I mean, he's done this literally from the first moments of his presidential campaign. And people remember his speech when he announced his candidacy was predicated on Mexicans are sending criminals across the border. That's why we need a wall. He has consistently argued that immigrants are a vector for crime in the United States, despite research demonstrating repeatedly that immigrants actually have commit crimes at lower rates than Americans, native-born Americans do. But he has this sort of overarching rhetorical argument, which is that immigrants are bad for the United States, and he has consistently, and last night wasn't the first time, used crime as a way of making that argument. People may remember he gave a big speech out on Long Island last year during which he did exactly that. He extrapolated outward from an MS-13 presence in Long Island to immigrants at large and the need for a wall on the border and so on and so forth. This is something he's done consistently, and I think that too goes back to your first point, which is that is not the sort of argument that is going to endear him to a lot of people who weren't already on his team.
He talked about the four pillars of immigration, including DACA, more than a million DACA recipients at some point, I believe over a 12-year period, getting access to citizenship. He talked about the wall. He also talked about family reunification or chain migration. And you had a really interesting piece, Philip, about how chain migration brought us the Trump White House. Can you expand on that?
So when Donald Trump says chain migration, he's referring to an immigration policy by which the relatives of citizens or immigrants are given priority in terms of consideration for entering the United States. So in other words, if you're a citizen and you have a cousin, I shouldn't say cousin because that's not
that's right.
There. Or you have a family member who fits the criteria and you want to bring them to the United States, they will be given, they can be given sort of bumped up in the queue, as it were. Historically, it has been the case that as immigrants came to the United States, they would often bring family members over. And that's something that happened to a great extent with members of the Trump administration. Donald Trump's mother came over and joined her sister in Queens, back in the 1930s, I think it was. His grandfather, Frederick Trump, came over and joined a family member as well. Mike Pence's grandfather joined a brother in the United States who himself had joined an aunt in the United States. Stephen Miller, who's sort of the architect of a lot of this hard-right immigration rhetoric from the White House, he too has family members who came over to the United States to join family members that are already here. That is the process which Trump now derides as chain migration, but it was a deliberate policy decision by the United States to unify families in the country, which now is being seen by the Trump administration as a negative.
I mean, it's how many people came to this country, not just the people in the Trump administration.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, one thinks of the sort of the historical narrative of American immigration, and it is that, you know, if some 16-year-old kid gets on a boat, comes over, gets off at Ellis Island, the next thing you know, he's writing back to his cousin, and his cousin comes over. I mean, you know, we've seen movies like this 100 times. This is sort of the story of American immigration to a large extent. But it is now, in part because the Trump administration broadly wants to limit immigration to the United States, it is now portrayed as being something that is anathema to the goals of the country.
How do you think that's going to play out as Congress debates this issue? And it's obviously more than just that, but it is the wall, DACA, and more.
Right. I mean, this is, you know, we exist in a moment of extreme polarization, which makes coming to compromise on pretty much anything fairly tricky. I mean, we haven't seen real compromise on something with any sort of contentiousness in a while, I think. And this is a very contentious issue. This is an issue in which the two parties hold pretty radically different positions even prior to Donald Trump becoming president, and he has further radicalized the position of the Republican Party. Yes, he advocates for a path to citizenship for these 1.8 million Dreamers who he identified in his speech last night, but his party's probably not going to go along with that. Oh. He advocates for this change to chain migration. Democrats are going to have a problem with that. It would be hard for him to put together an agenda which both parties could embrace simply because of the political moment. But the problem is he's actually widened that gap, not narrowed it.
We should add that changing or reforming immigration has eluded previous presidents, not just this one. Let me quote something that the president said last night. He said, "So tonight I call on the Congress to empower every cabinet secretary with the authority to reward good workers and to remove federal employees who undermine the public trust or fail the American people." Phil, that's been interpreted in a variety of different ways. How do you read what the president was saying there?
I think that one of the defining characteristics which we tend to overlook when we're considering President Trump is that he came to this job from a position that he held for decades as CEO of a business. And I think that he has been frustrated repeatedly by the constraints that a president faces, which a CEO does not. And I think that this fits with that broadly, which is that if someone isn't performing their job, he wants to be able to fire them without any questions asked. There is, however, historically, good reason for there being added protections for federal employees, which is that we haven't wanted the federal bureaucracy to be able to be swept out and then refilled with people who are loyal to a particular president or ideology. It has been seen in the past as a good thing to have continuity in the federal government and to make it harder for there to be a massive change in the government to be refilled with loyalists. It'll be interesting to see what actually happens with this. There is a lot of bureaucracy that comes into play here. But I think that's one of the things that people are a little worried about.
And some have interpreted it as a kind of a loyalty test, as Comey and others have said, that if you're not loyal to the president, your job is in jeopardy. Let me ask you about this memo. First of all, who's read this memo? And this is coming from the House Intelligence Committee, voted to be released, put together by the committee chair, Devin Nunes, voted entirely by Republicans on that committee, no Democrats.
That's right. So this is a memo, just to do a quick bit of context, this is a memo that was compiled by staffers for Devin Nunes. Nunes has been a very strong ally of President Trump's. People may remember that he was the one who Trump leaked some, or staffers for the White House leaked some information to Donald Trump, or to Nunes, in the spring of last year to defend those wiretapping comments that Trump had made on Twitter. So Nunes has been a strong ally. Some of his staffers wrote a memo that apparently makes the a case that the FBI misbehaved in its application for a warrant to survey someone who had been affiliated with the Trump campaign. So far, it's only been seen by some members of the House, and now over the weekend, the FBI Director Christopher Wray got a chance to look at it. He has already weighed in and said that it has inaccuracies. It seems pretty clear, based on the evidence at hand, that this is a memo that essentially was created to make the case for reasons that the FBI should not be trusted, and that that case was being made as part of the broader defense of President Trump from the investigation of Robert Mueller. But again, it is a classified document that itself points to further classified material, so even if it is made public, there will still be subtext to it that no one will be able to see because it points to classified documents, so it's going to be hard to contextualize it even if it becomes public.
The Democrats have their own memo countering the Republicans' memo. And then last night, you tweeted this, but last night as Trump was leaving the House chamber, Representative Jeff Duncan, he's a Republican from South Carolina, asked him whether he would release the memo. And I guess it's the ball essentially is in the president's court. And Trump responded, apparently, don't worry, 100%. How do you interpret that?
I will say, stepping aside from his comment last night, it seems pretty clear that Donald Trump would love to have this memo out there because it makes the case that he has been making, which is that the FBI can't be trusted in its investigation of him. It's the case, I think, that isn't a particularly robust one, but it's the one that Trump wants to make. That particular comment, though, it's hard to interpret what he said. He sort of, you know, it's people who've watched the State of the Union know that as the president enters and leaves, he goes through this sort of gauntlet of legislators wanting to shake his hand and say hi to him. This is him on his way out. The camera just happens to be there having a quick conversation. To me, honestly, it looked like he was sort of being sarcastic as though saying that it wasn't quite that easy a decision. It's hard to read, but there's little reason to suggest that Donald Trump really has a whole lot of qualms about releasing this thing.
And we have about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye to you. Is Rod Rosenstein, is his job on the line?
I mean, I think that anyone who puts Donald Trump in an uncomfortable position and who Trump has the ability to put pressure on in their employment probably should be worried about the status of their employment. I mean, there are a lot of political issues at play, and Donald Trump could pay a price for firing Rod Rosenstein, but that doesn't mean that he wouldn't.
We're going to end on that note. Philip Bump, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And he's national correspondent for the Washington Post covering politics. We're going to take a very short break and then shift gears talking with novelist Alif Shafak. She's got a new book, Three Daughters of Eve. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Alif Shafak is one of the most popular and acclaimed writers in Turkey, who was put on trial a decade ago because of something one of her characters said in her novel, The Bastard of Istanbul. She was acquitted. Her new novel, Three Daughters of Eve, toggles back and forth between Istanbul in the 1980s and 2016 and Oxford University at the turn of the 21st century. The story begins when Peri, a wealthy woman who's on her way to a dinner party, gets stuck in Istanbul's notorious traffic. A thief steals her pocketbook and she gives chase. A Polaroid from her college days falls from her purse, which brings back memories of her relationship with Shirin, an upper-class Iranian Muslim, and Fiona, an Egyptian American. They call themselves the sinner, the believer, the confused. Alif Shafak joins us on Radio Times to talk about her new book, The Fading Dream of a Democratic Turkey, What Authoritarian Regimes Mean for Women and for Writers. Alif Shafak, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Tell us about Peri. This is how the book begins. She's stuck in traffic, and as I described in my introduction, something happens.
Indeed. The entire book actually takes place across a supper scene, a dinner scene, with the starters, the main course, the desserts. And with flashbacks, we travel to Piri's youth and her years in Oxford University. But to be honest, those chapters where I talk about the supper scene and people coming together were maybe the most realistic chapters in this book. And at some point, I wanted to name this novel The Last Supper of the Turkish Bourgeoisie. Louis Buñuel's film, indeed.
The discreet charm of the bourgeoisie, right?
Yes, because each and every novel that I have written has been very different. I was a different person when I started writing. By the time I finished the book, I was a different person. Mm-hmm. Books do change us. But particularly this novel, perhaps, is very close to the bone. Mm. Everything so much of what I have seen directly in Turkey, witnessed, heard, has seeped into this novel directly.
When was the last time you were in Turkey?
It's been more than a year now. And when I was writing this novel, like late 2015, 2016, you might remember there were unfortunately so many terror attacks in Turkey, one after another in different parts of the country. So at these dinner scenes, you would go and there was almost a schizophrenia. One moment people would be talking about very mundane things like designer bags, looking at each other's clothes. And then the next moment someone would check their Twitter feed and realize there has been another attack. And then they would be talking about death. And then again, the mood would change. So that cultural schizophrenia was, for me, very painful to watch and observe. And I think I reflected that in the book as well.
This is a very trite question, but there's a long description about purses, about fake purses, about...
But it's true.
Why? I mean, I know this is not unique to Istanbul, but just the idea that a purse meaning something...
Yes, I think this happens a lot, actually, across the Middle East in more patriarchal societies. Unfortunately, women observe a lot what each other is, are wearing. But in the case of Pire, I think I wanted to reflect her confusions. As you know, as you mentioned in the book, there are three girls. They call themselves jokingly the sinner, the believer, and the confused. And it wasn't a coincidence that the Turkish one was the confused one. We are a very confused nation when it comes to our identity, where we stand, that in between them, between East and West, this could have been a source of richness if only we could have seen it that way, but we haven't. So I wanted to reflect that mood as well.
Well, she is in between her parents, her very different parents. Her father is a religious skeptic. He believes in science and reason. Yeah. He loves Ataturk. Her mother is basically a believer, but a believer in that kind of intense and passionate way. And she is caught between these two parents. One of the things that you write is no family fight is more hurtful than the one over God.
That is so true. And as you know, Turkey has become increasingly polarized over the years, bitterly politicized, which is a trait I observe in other countries as well. And I find it very unhealthy because when societies are divided into cultural, political ghettos, islands of people who do not talk to each other anymore, break bread together anymore, what you lose is a culture of coexistence around shared values. And without that, democracy can't be sustained. It is a very interesting, very complicated country, Turkey, but it also shows us that history does not necessarily move forward. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it goes backwards. If we don't learn anything from the mistakes of the past, we can make the same mistakes over and over again. And I believe for women, it is extremely worrying because when countries go backwards and slide into populism, ultranationalism, religious fanaticism and definitely authoritarianism, when these things happen, we women have much more to lose than men.
And why is that? Is it that the men are in control, or is it about the kind of control that comes from authoritarianism and who gets control but the women?
I think as nationalism increases, it's not a coincidence that sexism also increases, that kind of macho discourse that we see. But also all over the world, we see this across world history, the first things that will be curtailed, cut down are women's rights, minority rights, LGBT rights. So we can't take these rights for granted. And maybe in other parts of the world, women and minorities are coming to realize this. Mm. Even in relatively well-established democracies, things can go backwards very fast.
Is it because it's about sex?
It is about sex. And at the end of the day, I mean, Turkey, in my opinion, is a very patriarchal society. It is definitely male-dominated, sexist, and very homophobic. That doesn't mean that Turkish or Kurdish or Armenian, Jewish, Greek women living in Turkey are passive or victims at all. There are lots of vocal, active, amazing women in all fields. But there's one field in which women are almost non-existent, and that's politics. You know, at local, regional, and national level, politics is very much male-dominated. And unfortunately, in Turkey, politics is extremely aggressive, divisive, and that kind of language doesn't help women's rights either.
I'd love to have you read a section from your book, and this goes back to a Peri. She's young. She's living with these parents who do not agree. They can hardly be in the same room together.
Absolutely. Her parents are very, very different, and I think she observes and feels the pain of being the child of a couple who has never loved each other, you know. Her parents were as incompatible as tavern and mosque. The frowns that descended on their brows, the stiffness that infused their voices, identified them not as a couple in love, but as opponents in a game of chess. On the faded board of their marriage, they each pushed forward, strategizing the next moves, capturing castles, elephants and viziers, aiming to deliver the ultimate defeat. Each side saw the other as the tyrant in the family, the intolerable one, and longed to say, someday, checkmate, shahmanad, the sovereign is helpless. Their marriage had been so deeply woven with mutual resentment that they no longer needed a reason to feel wronged and frustrated. Even at that young age, Peri sensed that love was not, and probably never had been, the reason why her parents were together. In the evenings, she watched her father slumped at the table with plates of mezes distributed around a bottle of rakı, stuffed grape leaves, mashed chickpeas, grilled red peppers, artichokes in olive oil, and his favorite lamb's brain salad. He would eat slowly, sampling each dish like a fastidious connoisseur, even though the food was no more than a necessity so as not to drink on an empty stomach. I don't gamble, I don't steal, I don't accept bribes, I don't smoke, and I don't go around chasing women. Surely Allah will spare his old creation this much misdeed, Mansur was fond of saying. Ordinarily, he would have a friend or two join him for these lengthy suppers. They would rattle on about politics and politicians, depressed about the state of things. Like the majority of the people in this land, they talked most about the things they liked least. Travel the world, you will see everyone drinks differently, Mansur would say. He himself had moved around a fair amount in his youth as a ship's engineer. In a democracy, when a man gets drunk, he cries, what happened to my sweetheart? Where there's no democracy, when a man gets drunk, he cries, what happened to my sweet country? Soon, words would melt into melodies, and they would be singing bouncy Balkan tunes at first, revolutionary Black Sea songs next, and gradually, inevitably, Anatolian ballads of heartbreak and love. Turkish, Kurdish, Greek, Armenian, Ladino lyrics would mix in the air like coiling wisps of smoke. Sitting by herself in a corner, a heaviness of heart would come over Peri. She often wondered what it was that made her father so sad. She imagined sorrow sticking to him like a fine layer of black tar under the sole of his shoe. She could neither find a way to lift his spirits nor stop trying, for she was, as everyone in the family would testify, her father's daughter.
That is Elif Shafak, and she's reading from a section from her brand new book. It's a novel called Three Daughters of Eve. There is so much in what you just read there. I scribbled, you know, why did they get married in the beginning?
Yeah.
What? There must have been something that brought her parents together.
Of course, there's so many marriages that are similar to this one, actually, in Turkey and across the Middle East. Some of them are arranged marriages. Some of them maybe not arranged, but they were very young when they got married. And as the years went by, they moved in different directions, the couple. The way they responded to the challenges of life has been different. The mother, at the beginning, she is quite conservative, but she's not this much religious. And she becomes increasingly religious, and her notion of religion is very much fear-based. The father moved in a completely different direction, and like many of Turkey's Democrats today, I think he's quite depressed.
Oh, interesting. I mean, in certain ways, that couple is a stand-in for Turkey itself.
In a way, I think the family is like a microcosmos of the situation in the country in general. And it pains me to see the enormous gap, which has widened and widened over the years between the two sides.
You write beautifully about food. Are you a chef? I mean, do you cook? Do you love food? Do you love to eat?
How I wish I could be a chef. I'm terrible, you know, when it comes to
cooking.
Really? However, I love food. I love reading cookbooks. I love details. I gave a TED talk in which I mentioned how sometimes I feel like I can taste words, you know. I associate words with colors, colors with tastes. So it's a world that matters to me, the world of cooking and food.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, Alif Shafak, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She's got a new book, The Three Daughters of Eve. She's written other books as well. She has lived all over the world, spent some formative time growing up in Turkey. She lives in London now. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Talking about this novel, we'll be talking about her life as well, and obviously more about Turkey and about authoritarian governments. I'm Artie Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me read a section, and this is from this dinner party that Paris is going to. And one of the men says, "Frankly, I don't believe in democracy," said an architect with a crew cut and perfectly groomed goatee. His firm had huge profits from construction projects across the city. "Take Singapore," he says, "success without democracy. China, same. It's a fast-moving world. Decisions must be implemented by like lightning. Europe wastes time with petty debates while Singapore gallops ahead. Why? Because they're focused. Democracy is a loss of time and money." And obviously, in Turkey and other countries, democracy is under threat or democracy is losing. And in the case of Turkey, there was such hope for democracy in a Muslim country.
That is so true. And I think Turkey is such an important country. What happens there has repercussions beyond Turkey. I have had over the years many readers coming, you know, from Pakistan, from Kuwait, maybe Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, you know, coming and telling me we used to look at Turkey as maybe not a role model, but a possibility that it could happen, that a majority Muslim culture could embrace Western liberal values, that it was possible. And the fact that we failed so badly in that model, I think it sends a very bad signal to the entire Muslim world. So what happened in Turkey, I think the slide backwards, at first, in the beginning, it was gradual, but then it happened with a bewildering speed. Mm-hmm. And we've gone backwards in every respect.
Was there something, though, some precipitating event?
There are, I think, important turning points. I mean, one of those turning points was, of course, the collapse of the relations with EU, with Europe, which didn't help. The entire rhetoric has changed so much. I mean, my generation, we grew up thinking, believing that we were part of Europe. Whereas now the main narrative says, you know, we can join Shanghai Pact with China and Russia. Surely the right place to be if you do not care about human rights. I do not want my country to walk in that direction, you know, in the opposite direction. But overall, I think what the Turkish case shows us is the fragility of democracy, for sure, but also the fragility of the ballot box. Because the ballot box in itself is not enough to sustain a democracy. Relatively speaking, over the years, we had regular elections, you know. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't enough. So if you don't have rule of law in a country, if you do not have separation of powers, incredibly important, an independent academia, women's rights, minority rights, and definitely, definitely a free media, freedom of speech, a diverse media, if you do not have any of these components, the ballot box in itself, in the long run, will only lead to majoritarianism. Mm-hmm. Majoritarianism is not the same thing as democracy. The dominance of majority is a very dangerous thing, and it quickly evolves into authoritarianism.
Well, one of the wonderful things, at least about our constitution and our is the fact that minorities are protected. I mean, it's yes, the majority gets to decide, you know, who gets elected, but minorities are protected. Some question about how strong that is or not, but how important that is.
I think that's incredibly important, and it shows the quality of a democracy is measured not by looking at how well the majority is living or what the majority is doing. It is by looking at how well the minority is doing, you know, how they are being treated. That's how we measure the quality of a democracy. In Turkey, it is upside down. You know, it's just a topsy-turvy world. In a mature democracy, you would protect the individual or a minority against the excessive power of the state. In Turkey, it's the opposite. Even though the state is quite robust, you keep protecting the state against the words of individuals. Mm. That is why so many journalists, writers, academics can easily be put on trial on the pretext of insulting the state. Whatever that means, nobody knows it. And overall, I think today, words are very heavy in Turkey. And every journalist, every writer, every poet knows that because of something you say in an interview, a poem, an article, a novel, you can get into trouble so easily. Because we have that knowledge at the back of our minds, I believe there's widespread self-censorship, which is a difficult subject to talk about.
Indeed it is, because of the impulse to self-censor. And I do want to take a very short break. In fact, to pick up on that. And again, Elif Shafak is our guest. She's a novelist. She's got a new book, Three Daughters of Eve. And she's speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia at 7:30. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you are just joining us, Elif Shafak is our guest. One of Turkey's most popular and acclaimed writers was put on trial a decade ago for something one of her characters said about the Armenian genocide. I should add that she was acquitted. She has a new novel, Three Daughters of Eve, about three students studying at Oxford University. They call themselves the sinner, the believer, the confused. And the story goes back and forth in time between Oxford and modern-day Istanbul, reflecting some of the political turmoil in Turkey today. Let's talk a little bit about this, the Bastard of Istanbul. That's the book that ended you in a courtroom, or certainly put you on trial for something one of your characters said. This was about 10 years ago.
That is right.
And it was about the Armenian genocide.
Yes, I mean, it's the story of two families, a Turkish family and an Armenian-American family living in San Francisco, actually. But they have a common past, and that past is quite painful. And so it's a book that very much focuses on this duality between memory and amnesia. I think we in Turkey, we're a society of collective amnesia. Our entire relationship with the past is full of ruptures. And it's also a novel that perhaps tries to construct a more peaceful language by understanding the importance of the past, because I think memory is a responsibility, but hopefully trying to move forward together. So it tells the story through the eyes of women, generations of women, grandmothers, mothers and granddaughters on each side, both the Turkish family and the Armenian-American family. And this was a novel that was, you know, published in Turkey.
It was very popular in Turkey, was it not?
Yeah, that's why I hesitated, because there's two sides. I mean, it's unbelievably complex, because the inspiration and the energy I get from readers is amazing. And for that, I am most grateful. As a novelist, I am very much aware that if the novel is still well and alive in a country like Turkey, despite all the problems about freedom of speech, this is because of women readers. Huh. Most fiction readers are women. And the thing about women readers is they do not only read a book and then put it on their shelf. If they like it, they pass it on. So that word of mouth sharing, one item, one copy of a book in Turkey on average is read by 5 to 6 people. So people share, people talk.
That a communal experience.
A communal experience, and that to me is very, very precious. The dark side, however, is because of words, you can be put on trial. This was under Article 301, which protects Turkishness, even though nobody knows what that means. There have been many cases under Article 301, but maybe at the time my case was slightly unusual only because for the first time a work of fiction was put on trial. And as a result, my Turkish lawyer had to defend my Armenian fictional characters in the courtroom.
Wow. You were acquitted, so perhaps that tells us something. I'm wondering about more modern-day Turkey. I mean, obviously 10 years or so after that. Do you know journalists and writers and others who have either been arrested or jailed or exiled or are prevented from writing at all?
Of course. I mean, there are so many people, as you know, just I don't know where to begin even. Today, the chair of Amnesty International's Turkey branch was finally released after over 8 months in jail. How can it be a crime to defend human rights, you know? When I look at academics, thousands of academics have lost their jobs. And please let us not take this lightly, because when I say they lost their jobs, their prospects of finding another job at another university within Turkey is almost nil. You know, some of them had their passports confiscated. We had over 1,000 academics who signed a peace petition. Because they signed that peace petition, they were either arrested or lost their jobs. Again, how can it be a crime to sign a peace petition? There are novelists, writers, journalists in jail or blacklisted or exiled. And I think overall, journalism is the most difficult profession in Turkey today.
Is it called the enemy? I mean, does the government refer to the press or to people who work for the press, reporters, as enemy of the people?
I think what's so scary is in one night you can be called a traitor because of something you dare to say. You know, if you speak up your mind and express yourself differently, immediately you can be called a betrayer and demonized in government, pro-government papers, almost lynched on social media. I need to add that for women, I think it's harder because there's an additional sexist language that gets involved immediately. So it's not only Turkey that where this is happening, but the case of Turkey is slide backwards. I find it very painful.
Do you pick your words more carefully because of that?
No, I don't. And there's a reason why I don't, because I make a distinction between fiction and nonfiction. When I am writing fiction, when I'm inside a novel, I try to stay in that world as long as I can and as deep as I can. So those imaginary characters become my friends and that fictional world becomes my reality. I try to forget, you know, what other people might say. Only when the book is over, the novel, and I hand it to my editor, then I start to get very anxious about what other people are going to say. But by then, it's too late. The novel is out, and I respect her own journey. On the other hand, when I give an interview, when I give a talk or write a nonfiction essay, it is different, and I feel the pressure. So I think it is in fiction that I feel more free. Interestingly, and that's because of the way the art of storytelling works.
It's so interesting to think about the sort of almost paradox then as writers in Turkey, where words can get you in deep, deep trouble, they become in certain ways more important. And in countries where you can say anything, the words don't seem to have the same kind of value. For instance, in this country, poets struggle to be heard. I mean, you know, really. If they sell 10,000 copies of a book of poetry, they're elated.
It is, isn't it ironic?
It is.
I mean, it is. It's very paradoxical. In countries like Turkey, where freedom of speech is endangered, I think paradoxically words matter even more. Books matter, stories matter even more. But overall, when I look at the world, I realize if you happen to be a novelist coming from either wobbly democracies or wounded democracies like Turkey, Egypt, Pakistan, Nigeria, Venezuela, the Philippines, Russia, if you happen to come from such countries, you do not have the luxury of being apolitical. However, I observe a change among writers, Western writers as well. I live in England. I have experienced post-Brexit, you know, during the referendum, what's happening across Europe, also in the States. Lots of things are changing and shifting. And I realize more and more Western authors are feeling the same kind of urgency to talk about, to speak up about, you know, issues that are happening around the world. So maybe Western authors will be changing and are becoming more politicized in that way, too.
Let me read from a chapter you call The List. This is Istanbul 2016. There are two kinds of cities in the world, those that reassure their residents that tomorrow and the day after that will be much the same, and those that do the opposite, insidiously reminding their inhabitants of life's uncertainty. Istanbul is the second kind. There's no room for introspection, no time to wait for the clocks to catch up with the pace of events. Istanbulites dart from one breaking news story to the next, moving fast, consuming faster, until something else happens that demands their full attention. I think that's the world. I think that's beyond Istanbul, which is just not just the pace of news, but just what it means to be living in today's both uncertain world, but also where you get bombarded with news and lies, you know, coming from what seems like almost all different directions.
That is true. We are bombarded by news, information, lies. And perhaps we need to remember that information is not the same thing as knowledge, and knowledge is not the same thing as wisdom. They're completely different things. So you're right, I see that pace in different parts of the world, maybe more intense in some parts of the world than other. But it's quite worrying, because when things are so fast-moving and complicated, then demagogues who come forward and say, you know what, I'm going to offer you simplicity, I have the solution, they gain a higher, louder voice. And I find that very worrying. So it's not a coincidence that at times like this, nationalism, tribalism, isolationism is on the rise. Unfortunately, demagogues are telling us that if we are surrounded by sameness, we will be safer. Mm-hmm. That is an illusion. Sameness does not mean safety. And we are far too much interconnected all around the world, all of us as human beings, to believe that by isolating ourselves from the rest of the world, we can be safer. The only way forward is through global solidarity around shared values of democracy, freedom of speech, human rights. But we can only do this together as human beings.
In many ways, you have lived that. You have lived in various parts of the world. Yeah. You were raised by your mom and your grandmother, in part in Turkey, but also in Spain for a while. Yeah. So do you feel that sameness is boring as well?
I think tribalism is very boring, but it's also dangerous because it erases individuality. You know, and that is why maybe I like the novel so much as a genre, because it directly speaks to the inner space. I have many readers in Turkey who are very xenophobic. You know, if you talk to them, because I have a very diverse readership, maybe publicly they will tell you all kinds of negative things about minorities, mm-hmm. about Armenians, Jews, Greeks, Kurds, Alevis, the main minorities in Turkey. But then they come and they say, you know, I've read your novel and I love this character. And the character they're talking about is maybe Armenian or Jewish or Greek. Similarly, I have many homophobic readers, because this is the only narrative they have heard as they were growing up. And then they come and they say, why did you make that character suffer? You know, and again, that fictional character they're talking about is maybe transsexual or bisexual or gay. So I've often wondered, how does it happen? People who are publicly more intolerant become relatively a little bit more ready to connect with the other when they are alone. All I'm trying to say is tribalism, to be part of masses, crowds, to the extent of erasing your individuality, is a very dangerous thing. And usually that is the fuel behind extremist ideologies.
Do you think it's the act of reading, in a sense, being alone with one's own imagination, but obviously the imagination of the author as well?
Absolutely. But then also we remember that the other is a human being. We connect with the story of the other, and the sorrows and the joys are familiar. It's not just numbers anymore. It's not just a category anymore, or labels. How dangerous it is to put labels on people.
You describe growing up and beginning to write. I think your mother gave you a journal to start writing in. But you said in many ways as a young kid that you were bored.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, a lot of kids are because they have to hang around adults and do semi-adult things.
That is true. I mean, of course, the fact that I did not grow up in a typical Turkish family, extended family, patriarchal family, maybe is important. I was born in France. Shortly afterwards, my parents got divorced. With my mother, we came back to Turkey, Ankara. And because my mom had dropped out of university at the age of 19, thinking love was enough.
Sort of like her.
When she came back as a young divorcee, she had no money, no diploma, no career, nothing to fall back on. And in this state, we came to my grandmother's house in Ankara. This was a very patriarchal, conservative neighborhood. And I remember people immediately looking for a suitable husband for my mother because a young woman is, you know, a danger to the society. But it was my Eastern traditional grandmother who supported her daughter's education. My mom went back to university, graduated. She became a diplomat, and together we traveled a lot. So if you're raised by a single working mother and if you're a single child, you do get bored, and maybe that's how I discovered Storyland.
Storyland. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And that's where you live, right? Storyland?
I do live in Storyland, but that world is not disconnected from this world. As I said, I don't think you have the luxury to say, I don't care about what's happening beyond my door. But if I make this distinction, I think writers should be asking questions, difficult questions about difficult issues, taboos, and try to give more voice to the voiceless, bring the periphery to the center. But it's not a writer's job to try to teach something. I don't like it when writers try to preach or teach, because it's up to the reader to find or to come up with their own answers. But it's the questions, to ask the right questions. I think that's our job.
In this novel, we're almost out of time here, but in this novel, Perry, as a girl, sees things. She sees a vision, something called a djinn. Mm-hmm. And in her imagination, it's a baby,
kind of
a fat baby. Mm-hmm. What's a djinn, and how are we supposed to understand? Is she seeing it? Is she what does that mean to her?
Right. I think this is the impact of my grandmother, because I was raised by these two women, my mother and my grandmother. And my grandma was a healer of a kind. Her house was full of magic, superstitions, irrationality. People would come, with skin diseases. She would heal them. So I'm very familiar with that oral culture that unfortunately many writers have looked down upon because it wasn't, knowledgeable enough. But I love to try to at least bridge oral culture and written culture and hopefully Eastern and Middle Eastern sources of storytelling with a much more Western way of storytelling.
So for her, it's real?
I think she's a confused being. Perry is confused. Yeah, she's in between. But this is a book that very much questions the certainty, not only of religiosity, but the certainty of atheism as well. So people who are looking for a third path, maybe agnostics, mystics, people who understand the importance of faith, but also the importance of doubt. That is what Perry maybe learns in the end, this dance, the dialectics of faith and doubt.
And I always hate to ask a novelist this question, but does that reflect you?
Actually, none of the three girls is me. I think I like to hide inside my male characters usually.
Oh, you do? Oh, my goodness. I wish I could follow up on that. Alif Shafak, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A great pleasure to have you on the show, and I thoroughly enjoyed your book, Three Daughters of Eve, and again, our guest, Alif Shafak. And she's speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.